So again, good morning, everyone. Again, a special welcome to the 70 or so participants in this retreat that began Friday night and is continuing till 4 o'clock this afternoon. The title subject matter of this retreat has been taking the self out of the life equation. And the facilitators for this retreat are Diane and Brian. And so the retreat continues to 4 o'clock today. So this is the Dharma talk within the context of also the retreat. And I have not been participating in retreat, so this is my first opportunity to be with the participants as well as the rest of you who are listening today. So why take the self out of the life equation? I think most people are trying to work very hard to put the self in the life equation. More and more. And yet, there is this retreat taking the self out of the life equation. And that comes out of a very particular insight that goes back to the Buddha. In his own deep introspection into his mind, into his experience, and to really a resolve for himself. The fundamental issue is, why do people suffer? You know, why is there suffering in life? And of course, it is a fairly complex matter in a certain way. But whether it was in the earliest formulations of the Buddha in the Four Noble Truths, the fact of, well, suffering strong, but it really has to do with kind of a fundamental unsatisfactoriness within life, even when things work. Because of impermanence, because of many things, things always change. So there's nothing, everything settled. And the Buddha called that unsettledness, that unsatisfactoriness, that sense of something missing. He called that suffering. Not getting what we want is suffering. Getting what we don't want is suffering, et cetera, et cetera. So this is the... But when he looked in the second noble truth, the cause of suffering, he saw very clearly that the cause of suffering was this thing called the self. That in a personal way shows up in our life as, you know, the I word, the me word, the mine word. That begins with this subjective sense that I am here. I am seeing. I am hearing. I am smelling. I am tasting. I am sensing. I am feeling. I am remembering. I am wanting. I am needing. I am happy. I am sad. I mean, it goes on and on and on. But this subjective sense of self seemed to be right at the crux of the human experience. In his time in Sanskrit, that was called Atman, the self. And in his three marks of existence. He delineated what he called that the fundamental principle of the way things really are is anatman, non-self. And that this fundamental delusion, he called it a delusion, the self-delusion, that the experience of a subjective experience, to see that as a permanent solid thing called a self, a me, a my, is where it is kind of the fundamental departure that all human beings make that brings them away from their true self and brings them into the world of separation, duality, suffering, dissatisfaction. Now, there are many things that can be said about self, and I'm sure for those on the retreat, I have heard many things. But what I wanted to talk about this morning was something I've referred to in other talks in the past, but it always bears a hearing again until we really get it. And how do we know we really get it? Because it's a consistent way of looking at things. It's sort of like driving, you know, if we know how to drive, it's not like every time we get in the car, we have to kind of try to remember whether we know how to drive or not. Try to remember how to drive, figure out how to drive, how to turn the thing on, how to back it up, how to turn. I mean, you know, once we know how to drive, we just get in the car and drive. And once we really understand, the nature of self, and we really live from what might be called a non-self view as opposed to a self-centered view, it is the same. It is a fundamental change in how we live our life, perceive life, relate to life, people, etc. So this issue of self and what is the self and is the self real and is it solid and is it permanent, again, was the, you know, one of the most fundamental issues that the Buddha resolved in his great enlightenment, but also has been the subject of Buddhism in its development over thousands of years. Buddhism has a very profound psychological system, a profound analysis of the mind, and the centrality of self has a place there. Now, let me just, again, I've given talks, workshops on Buddhist psychology, so I won't go into the whole this morning, but I do want to go into a piece of it that directly relates to the work people have been doing in this retreat on self. So in the Buddhist map of the mind, there is what's called the upper levels of the mind. And this is apparent to all of us, right? Eyes seeing. We see, we hear, we smell, we taste, we sense, we feel, and we think, and we perceive, and we remember, right? I mean, we have, these are called the six senses, which are the five senses of the body, and then this manovijnana, this kind of thinking, conceiving, discriminating mind. We all have that, right? But the question for the Buddha and the ancients was, but where does this sense of self come from, which seems to be so strong in us? You know, because we think all that's going on, you know, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, sensing, thinking, we think that this is all going on and is run by and is all about me. And it has an identity and it has a name. And so this, because if you look in your body, if you look into your seeing, I'm sure people on retreat did this, if you look into seeing, if you look into smelling, if you look into tasting, you cannot find a self, right? All you can find is just the sensual experience. And if you look into your thinking mind, you will find thoughts and perceptions and memories, but you can't find this thing that we call me, this permanent entity. And again, we all think it's permanent entity because we all think, you know, well, I was born here and then I did this when I was one and this when I was two and this when I was five and this when I was 15 and this happened to me. You know, we all have a long narrative of which the central character is me. So the question for the Buddhists is, you know, what is the seat of this I, right? I mean, can you see it's a very fundamental question. And not only does this self attach itself to all the upper level experiences, you know, I am seeing and I am hearing, I am smelling, I like what I see, I don't like what I see, I like what I smell, I don't, you know, it's not only is the I doing that, but then also, and I won't get into it, there is this vastness of our kind of unconsciousness, subconsciousness, which is, you know, all the memories, all our stuff. You know, where does all our stuff come from? All our stuff that seems to always come out in relationship to what's going on, right? Our likes, our dislikes, our issues, our, you know, the you know, our core beliefs. You know, where's all so that in that storehouse? Now, there's also we see all our stuff as what? As belonging to me, right? So not only does the self lay claim to everything that's happening around us and have a perception, a like, a dislike, a view on everything that's arising, but it also claims that, you know, that all its stuff is mine too. My stuff, my neuroses, my problems, my issues, my childhood, my, right? So the self, and yet when you look deeply into your sort of this unconscious part, which you really, you know, you can't find anything there. So what is this? So they said, you know, what is the seat of this self, of this I, me, mine, of this entity, seemingly entity that attaches itself, identifies itself with everything that it sees, hears, smells, tastes, remembers, etc. And they called this the seventh level of consciousness, manas. M-A-N-A-S, manas. The one who attaches. Thich Nhat Hanh, in his writing on Buddhist psychology, he called manas, he called it the lover. Because manas loves itself, right? It loves its thoughts, it loves its feelings, it loves its suffering, right? It just can't get enough of it. You know, it's, he calls it the lover. In Greek mythology, it was called what? Narcissus. Remember Narcissus? Narcissus could never get enough of himself, right? What he loved, nothing he better he loved in doing than what? What? Gazing into the lake to see his reflection, right? I mean, that's what he lived for. Right? And in the same way, that's a description of manas. We're always concerned about ourself. How do I look? How am I dressed? What do people think of me? How can I get my needs met? Right? From morning to night, right? Manas is very busy. Right? And when things don't go its way, what happens? angry, gets frustrated. When it's afraid that things will not work out the way it wants, it gets anxious or scared. When it loses what it wants, it gets sad, right? I mean, Manas is very busy. So it is this seventh level of consciousness, Manas. Again, it's not as if we can see it. This is the seventh and eighth consciousness are just parts of the mind that we can, that kind of by deductive reasoning we can come to, because we know that we have this deep identification with self, right? That I'm me. And that this me, this Fred, you know, is the center of my universe. And I live for him. My whole purpose in life is to guide him through life so he gets what he wants and doesn't get what he doesn't want. Right? Right? Isn't that what we're consumed with? Keeping self happy. Right? And so this endless struggle of self in the world, self with others, conflicts, all this. The Buddha said, this is suffering. Identification with self is suffering. Living from Manas is suffering. So, this issue of self is very fundamental in Buddhism. Now, please understand, Buddhism does not deny a subjectivity kind of me-ness, right? I mean, there is a sense that we're here. Is that clear? I mean, right, there is a sense that, you know, like each of you are listening, and there's a sense that you're hearing, right? I mean, it's not, There is a subjective sense of me-ness, right? Buddhism does not deny that, but what it says is this subjective sense of me-ness is not an entity, is not a thing, is not a permanent thing that continues over time. This is the difference. Buddhism does not say that our identification as a permanent solid self is based on reality. It's not the way things are. Buddhism says there really isn't. There is not a permanent solid self over time that exists at all. Because another one of the three marks of existence is the mark that all existence has beside non-self is the mark of impermanence. Nothing is solid. Nothing stays the same, right? I mean, even though the Buddha and the great meditators discovered this through their introspection and meditation, now we know that modern physics and everything else says the same thing. You know, everything is energy, everything's in motion, everything is changing, nothing is solid. Things are changing moment to moment, moment to moment, right? You know, there's no constant stream. You know, you look in your mind and what do you see? One thought after another, right? Endless. You know, there's no continuity. Endless thoughts, endless feelings, endless sensations, endless interactions. The universe that Buddha saw was just an endless unfolding of life. Endless unfolding of causes and conditions. Endless unfolding of experience. But self, this identification as a solid self, takes all that process and turns it into what? Into a solid thing called me. And this is a fundamental departure from truth. It's really a fundamental departure from how we came in the world as infants, as children, right? Before we had language, before anybody told us that we have a name, before anybody told us that, you know, these are your toys, these are your friend's toys, these are your sister's toys, don't, you know, before the world was divided up, we didn't see life that way. And so this process of getting more deeply and deeply ensnared in this identification of self, which to each of us has its own, you know, its own particular narrative, its own particular feeling, its own particular identification, is different from everybody else's. And every human being has the same thing going on. So this is something that over decades, and if those of you who remember being a child or those of you who raised children, you can see it. You can see this identification with self developing, and over time it gets harder and harder, meaning it gets more of a shell, gets more of an encasement. It gets more and more of a identification. And so usually by the time we reach adulthood, we really are very identified very solidly with who and what I think I am. And so many people think, I mean, most people just go through life based on that. And then there are many people who realize, ooh, this, you know, there are parts of this that don't work. And so we are endlessly trying to make modifications in self, self-identity, self-improvement, prove the self. And yet Buddhism, this is why it's so important that we understand this. That's not how Buddhism looks at things. Right. It says there is no permanent solid identification. There's no thing. It cannot be found. And it is a process that through meditation, introspection, reflection, everyone can see that. You know, you do an autopsy on the body and you lay out all its parts, you will not find anything called a self. Anybody ever see an autopsy? you won't find a self. And when you look in your mind, you won't find a self either. You will find thoughts, feelings, perceptions, memories. You'll find an array, same way in our body, you'll find an array of matters, systems, organs, tissues, cells, you know, endless. Same way in the mind, endless. But you will not find this solid self that believes it's the center of things. And everyone who's listening to this call can go through that process. So this uncovering, this journey from identification of self to non-identification with self, this transformative process is really the fundamental process of the Buddhist path. And again, it's fundamentally based on this totally different view of what the human being is and what a human mind is than Western psychology, which posits these entities as being real solid things, such as an ego, a self. Buddha psychology does not say there's not a subjective sense that there's a me. It just says when you look into it, you cannot find it. It's just the feeling. But when we identify strongly with it, that feeling then becomes the basis of our reality. It's like any other delusion we have. Right? We have lots of delusions. We think certain things are real when they're not real, right? And if you investigate your delusions, you should be able to see, right, that you really are not Jesus Christ, right? Okay? Or any other delusion we have about ourselves, life, people. A delusion is something that is not true. That's why it's called a delusion, right? And people who are trapped in their delusions believe their delusions are real. Very dangerous. Now, most of us live the life of delusion, but because everybody else is part of the same, is living the same delusion, it continues. It's only when your delusions become really, extreme, right? That somebody says you have a mental health problem. Is that clear? But up to that extremity where it really begins to affect your behavior in an incredibly negative way, we're able to function in society tolerating our delusions. Even though they clearly are not based on reality. And even though that our identification, believing our delusive notions about self are real, they create suffering. They create separation. They create disharmony. They create conflict. And yet, we persist because of this misidentification. So this is, I'm just trying in a very brief way, speaking to everyone, speaking to people on retreat, how essential this psychological understanding of self is, of understanding manas, and understanding why, even though it feels that way, and even though we've historically built up this narrative to support it, upon investigation, anybody can see it is fundamentally not true. And I've used this analogy many times, and I'll use it again in the same way, by opening the closet door and turning on the light, we can show our children that there really, there really is not a monster in the closet. Right? In Buddhism, the analogy that's often used, it's like somebody, it's kind of twilight. And they go outside and they see this thing in the garden and it looks like a snake. And so they immediately get scared and run off. And they run back into the house and they tell somebody else, quick, come, there's a dangerous snake in the garden, it's big. And the person gets the light and comes out. It's not a snake, it's just a rope. And yet the rope, when not seen clearly, look like a snake, right? It doesn't, you see what I'm saying? It's not saying there's not a rope there, you see. We're not saying that there's not some subjective sense of me here, but to think it's a real thing, to think that the rope is a snake is a misperception. Misperceptions can be corrected. So the real, more deeper purpose of Buddhist meditation, both analytical meditation and direct looking, insight meditation, is to see that which appears to be a solid real thing upon investigation, upon deep looking, one can see there's no thing there. Right? You can know the narrative of your life minutely. This happened, this happened, this happened, this happened, this happened. But that which links them all to me cannot be found. And this is profound. Why is it profound? Again, it is this identification with that I am a solid, permanent thing is really the basis of it. It is pervasive and it contaminates everything. Whether it's my own inner experience, whether it's my experience in relationship, whether it's my experience in the world, or, you know, if you attend to the political, social situation of the world and the problems, it's all because of what? Selves, identified as a self, identified with their thoughts, identified with their needs, their greeds. Totally encapsulated in this womb of self-centeredness, narcissism, pride, arrogance. I mean, self has many variations. There's self-delusion, there's self-identification, there's conceit, there's pride, there's self-love. Right? I mean, that is, according to Buddhism, fundamentally the major cause of the suffering of human beings and the suffering they bring into the world. I do want to leave time for questions, you know, especially from people who've been on retreat. So the practice is fundamentally to understand, you know, intellectually, this whole process of non-self, of manas, so we can kind of reset our psychological understanding experientially through meditation, insight, etc., reflection, to really uproot it. And then what? Now, lo and behold, we find there is another way to live. Another way to live that is not based on me, my needs, my wants, my desires, you know, my self-love, my conceit, my pride, as being the center of my universe. When I, if you can think about self-identification, self-centeredness, self-conceit, self-love, it means I'm always looking here. And it's only through this that I then look out. And all I see in the world is a world of objects and people that are there for what purpose? To meet my needs. I mean, as simple as that, right? Isn't that what everybody's there for? You know, why do we get frustrated, angry, what? Because somebody's not meeting my needs. Somebody's not doing it the way I want. Whether it's a person, I mean, even our loved ones will get angry with, right? Why? They're not doing it our way. So when we break out of this self-centered, self-loving, self-conceited, self, all this world, we then have a way of relating to others that is fundamentally different. Because it's no longer from the place of self, of I, me, my, of conceit, self-love. It's now we have the capacity of loving others, of caring for others, of even having the crazy thought that maybe I want to devote my life to helping others be happy. I mean, I used to think my only purpose in life was to make Fred happy, right? I mean, that's an impossible job, isn't it? Because self is never happy, is it? Right? Every time your self gets happy for a little bit because somebody's meeting its needs or somebody's, or it's working out the way you want, you're happy, but it'll quickly change, right? But my, you know, it's never satisfied. So in Buddhism, the way of living that's encouraged and taught and practiced is a way that is based on selflessness, less self. We may not be perfect enlightened Buddhas, totally free, right? But we can be less self, less self-centered, less selfish. And we can be more oriented toward the world. Less always coming from a place of me. You know. It's really quite, when one is no longer living from this self place, and again, self has so many likes and dislikes, and, right? It's endless. When that's kind of no longer, it's not like it's all God. I mean, ideally it'd be all nice. But if it's just seen in perspective, one can sort of then go through life without such rigidity, right? Without such tightness, without always being in conflict with life, with people. And one can be at ease, right? So what if things aren't going my way? So what if the food doesn't taste the way I'd like it to taste? Right? You know what I mean? So what? You know, we all have this little, 12-year-old inside us, you know, kind of, you know. But, you know, it's like, it's okay, you know, it's okay. It's okay. You know, we have now the possibility of being more understanding, more forgiving, more accepting. I mean, all those wholesome possibilities of being in the world are now possible. And it's no longer a struggle. When we're in the world of self, you know, to really be wholesome genuinely, to really be generous genuinely, is a struggle. And even though we may act it inside, it's often not congruent. But when self is let go of, when we're less self, less self-centered, it is much easier to just be natural and genuine in the world. So in Buddhism, you know, the positive thing is cultivating the altruistic path, the selfless path, the path of love, compassion, understanding, generosity, you know, all that good stuff. And that becomes a lot easier and possible with what I've shared so far. So I wanted to leave time for everyone, but especially the people on retreat, either in terms of what I said or anything that is lingering from retreat, even though I'm sure Brian and Diane did a good job. You know, there's always things that aren't clear, not understood. So if you could chat in your, you'll see at the bottom of your screen, there is a chat function. And if you would just chat in to Angie's on the screen, and you'll repeat them to me, Angie.
So here is a question. So right now I'm looking at you, Fred, and I see a self. You look like a real self.
Mm-hmm.
Likewise, I see other selves, other people. I'm understanding that there is no permanent self, that people are not solid, permanent things. That makes sense. But when I see a person or people in front of me, it's difficult to deny that I do see a person, a self.
Okay.
How else can we love a person if we do not acknowledge that they are a self? Who are we loving?
That's interesting. I mean, obviously I'm not sure who's asking the question, but I look out, there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 people in the room. I don't see any selves. I see that, right? Self is a label. We have to understand, we project. Self is a word that we put on. And the Diamond Sutra says, Buddhas do not see a self, a permanent, they don't see that. Because there is no self there. I mean, I'm looking at Ryan, right? That's his name. That's the label for that. But really, what am I seeing? I'm seeing, just to give it one word, a body. That's all I am seeing, right? I'm seeing a body. Now, in the relative world, we say, that's Ryan's body. But again, I mean, if I did an autopsy on Ryan right now and laid out his body, I would not find anything in that body called Ryan, right? But you put it all together and we give it a name, Ryan. Well, we'd say, oh, but, you know, the real Ryan's inside in his mind. But if I looked in his mind, what would I find? Thoughts, feelings, perceptions, memories coming and going. I wouldn't find any solid thing called Ryan. So we can use these words, person, just the way we can use the word self. But again, Buddhism says that which appears. Right? This is important. Buddhism doesn't deny the world of appearance. Things appear that way, right? Clouds appear solid, but they're not, right? Right now, we're here in the hall and we hear a sound, right? Katie just looked out and, right? It's raining, right? And yet, there's no thing called rain out there. You went out there, what's really going on? Drops, wetness. We give it a name, we call it what? Rain. But there's really no such entity called rain, right? All of a sudden this entity rain, you know, like it's a solid thing. No, it's just causes and conditions are coming together. That's another teaching of causes and conditions are coming together with, you know, whatever the causes or conditions are. That cause clouds to form, the certain kinds of clouds to form, and those clouds form and they hold moisture, and at a certain point, you know, the moisture just falls. It's a process. But yet we say, oh, I see a cloud. Oh, it's raining. I mean, that's okay. That's where we talk to each other. But I know clouds aren't real things, real solid things. I know there's no real solid thing called rain, because when this rain's over, it'll be gone. If it was real and really self-existent, it would continue on, but it doesn't. In the same way I see Ryan, I'll call him Ryan, but I know there's really no solid Ryan in there. He's changing all the time. Changing, changing, changing. Nope. Yeah, we have to, yeah, this is not easy. And I appreciate the question, because we do, you know, I don't love somebody because they're a person. I don't need to call them a person to love them. Love is, you know, love is not a thing. Things just unfold. We think we need an I and a you to love. Actually, I and you get in the way of loving. That's the truth. Yes.
Questions that are somewhat related. Is it accurate to say that self exists subjectively but does not exist objectively? Is this
Sorry, Angie, because of the rain, I'm having trouble hearing you.
So then, is it accurate to say that self exists subjectively but does not exist objectively? Is this the non-duality of self? And someone else asks, can you explain the concept of emptiness as it pertains to self?
Yeah. So again, I mean, this is, you know, it's right. So in terms of the first one, yes. So in Buddhism, and this is what we talk about, the two levels, the relative, the absolute, form and emptiness. Yeah, Buddhism does not deny how things appear. There is a subjective sense of me, right? I mean, if somebody, you know, if Ryan all of a sudden came over to hit me, I wouldn't just go, yeah. I mean, there is a subjective self-sense that has a self-protective mechanism, right? I mean, we're hungry, we eat. I mean, yeah. So it's saying, yes, there's a subjective feeling, it appears to be that there's a self, but upon investigation, see, it's upon investigation. That's why deep looking is so important in Buddhism, because if we live at superficiality, right, such as, right? I'm looking at everybody in the room. Everybody looks real. Everybody looks solid, right? And yet it's not true. Everybody in this room, their body is in the process of decomposing, right? Isn't that true? Yeah, I mean, if we speak the truth, but we don't see that. It's not apparent, right? You know, the empty nature, the non-solid nature of seemingly solid things is not apparent, right? It also, in this moment, we can't see impermanence because everything is right now. It's only through deep looking that we realize, oh, yeah, I mean, you know, I started out at home, then I came here, and I'll go back home, or I'll go somewhere else, or I'll never make it home, right? Who knows? Yeah, this moment is impermanent, right? So it's only by deep looking that we see how things really are. But you all understand that, right? I mean, that's our own process of insight. I mean, it's only, you know, when we look deeply into things, when we step back from life and go, yeah, what do I really think? What do I really feel? What's really happening? That we get some insight into ourselves. People who never stop and look deeply have no insight, and they never change, right? And a lot of those people are running the world, unfortunately. You know, it's too bad they don't have this insight. Both the insight of non-self as well as an understanding of, you know, we're here to care for one another and not just ourselves, or not just a few people and not others. Did I answer both of them, Angie? I'm like, yeah, okay.
By certain actions we take. For instance, if I react to myself or someone else's self, self seems to become more solid.
Yeah.
If that's the case, how do we loosen self's grip?
Well, okay, yeah, so yes, that's true. That is the process we've been in since childhood, okay? And we are, and depending on, yeah, you know, as we see in life, and maybe we see in ourselves, there could be people here who've been practicing a while, and say, yeah, I used to be much more self-centered, right? I used to be much more conceited. I used to be much more prideful, you know what I mean? You know, I was much more concerned what everybody thought about me or my self-image or, you know, everybody had to respect me. But as I've practiced, I've loosened up, right? It's become looser, softer. You know, even though we still are self-identified, it's more permeable, you know, things get through more. So, yeah, so... So the practice is going through a process where we kind of keep resetting, right, the fundamental place that we live from, right? So we soften it. So we open. And you're absolutely right that every time we get in, you know, and you know it, the stronger the identification with self, especially again, when self feels threatened or self is not getting its needs met or self is, you know, things are happening that it doesn't want. You feel the constriction, don't you? The world of self is a very tight world. It's a world of great emotionality, ups and downs. I mean, and just crisis after crisis. That's the world of self, right? Because the world's impermanent. Because just things are happening and self is just freaking out because it can't control it, right? I mean, so it's, yeah. So you know, yeah, the more drama in your life, the more emotionality in your life, the more crises, emotional crises in your life, yeah, the stronger the sense of self. You know, when you loosen that grip, when you open, when you accept, when you understand, when you love, when you have compassion for. It's a very different feeling. Yeah, exactly right.
There are several questions of what you might call the larger I or self or presence. For example, how can I have a Buddha nature if there's no I? Or is there a universal self that this self connects to?
Say that again, how can I...
How can I have a Buddha nature if there's no I? And what gets reincarnated?
Yeah, this is all right. Let's take, is that one person or is those three different questions? Okay, so give me them one at a time. They're all not different. What was the first one?
Can I have a Buddha nature if there is no I?
Well, so the opposite would be to have a Buddha nature, one needs a self. I mean, does water need a self to be wet? Does sugar need a self to be sweet? Does salt need a self to be salty? I mean, I think this is one of the fundamental problems we have, that we think we need a thing called a self. A thing called a self. Right? To live life. Now again, we need a sense of self so we don't walk into traffic, so we, observe the speed limit, so we, you know, but that is not a self. That is really just the conscious thinking mind that perceives and is developing some degree of intelligence to navigate the world. Yes, we need intelligence. We need discernment. But to say the nature of mind, the nature of who I am, in Buddhism we say that, you know, our nature is empty. Now, what does that mean? Empty of self, empty of permanence, empty of solidity. That's what it means. It's empty of. It's not like a thing called emptiness, because then we turn emptiness into a thing, an entity. There's no things. Yes. So the nature of, if you want to use the word self, if you investigate yourself, you will see its nature is empty. That empty nature is our Buddha nature, our non-self nature. And it has its own wisdom, its own clarity, which is very different than self. Self is devoid of wisdom because it only sees itself. It's only concerned with itself. It only sees the world as a reflection of, remember Narcissus, right? Narcissus only looks at his reflection. We think we're seeing the world. We're not seeing the world. We're not seeing people. Right? Everything is being filtered through this pervasive sense of self and all its likes and dislikes and conditioning and issues. Right? So it's, in, this is getting into another whole area, but I mean, the idea that somehow we are living life, in reality, we are not. We are living life in through these constructs that we project onto life and then and then filters experience. Right? I mean, we hear a sound, I mean, and right away, like, dislike. Right? See a person, like, dislike. Or we make some comment about them, as if that's real. As if our views are real. As if our ideas are real. No, it doesn't mean they arise. It doesn't mean human beings don't have these things. But to think they're real, solid things, that's where we get tripped up. So yeah, so basically, the most hopeful, positive thing about Buddhism, it says, even this whole self and the whole fabrication that we've created isn't an entity. It's not a solid thing. It's just made up these endless parts, these endless reifications. And if we go through a process of understanding that, yeah, then we have the possibility of living a totally different life. The life of a Buddha, the life of a Bodhisattva, you know. What does it mean to be enlightened? It's not like enlightenment's a thing. Enlightenment means the light is on, I see things as they are, right? That's the difference between a Buddha and an ordinary being. Ordinary being doesn't see clearly. Sees things through the filter of delusions. Enlightened person sees clearly how things are. The light is on. I'm enlightened about something. So don't make it too mystical. Yes.
Is the thinking, planning mind the same as the self? And if not, how do they relate to each other?
No, the thinking, planning mind is the thinking, planning mind. It is an attribute of mind. You don't need a self. You know, it's just, you know, this is, remember, the five upper levels, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, sensing. Those are your five senses. Then your six, the Manoj Bhijnata, is your thinking. That's where you think, you plan, you think logically, you analyze, right? You remember. That's all those processes, right? Are in your seventh, in your sixth level. The seventh level is the Manas. It claims. I used to call it, some of my talks used to call it, it's like, remember imperialism? Remember? Like the Spanish show up in America, even though there's a well, highly developed culture and civilization, you know, what do the Spanish do? They say what? I claim this for the queen, right? I mean, it's like they go around planting their flags on all these places where already people are living and think that this is their country. No, I claim it. Okay. That's what self does. You see, it goes around and whatever processes you're involved in, it claims it for itself. And we're convinced we need it. You don't need it. Now again, a sense of self, our sense of self got us here, right? Where we realize because of our capacity of our mind to introspect. See, these are capacities all human beings have in their sixth level of mind. But because we have this capacity to introspect, we have the capacity of talking about what we're talking about, right? Of looking into our experience, of looking into these matters and trying to, you know, work it through. Right? So if there wasn't a part of us that kind of was able to look at life and say, you know, certain parts of my life are not working, right? Now again, to say that there's a subjective sense of self that kind of navigates things is not to say that this subjective sense of self is a solid, real thing. That's what we're saying. That's why really in Buddhism we say, in Buddhism, the self is a non-self, which is acknowledging the truth of both. The rainbow appears, the cloud appears. That's true. It's consensual reality. We all agree. But to think it's a solid, permanent thing that's always going to be there, it's not true. Upon investigation, this building that appears so solid will not always be here. I mean, it's rotting away as we speak. We just can't see it, right? The termites are eating away at it, right? I mean, we don't... You know, and that's what's going on. I mean, we think it, but we can't see it. So we think it looks solid, and then one day, you know, the thing collapses. Because things are not as they appear. This is very important. It doesn't deny that they don't appear that way. Right? I mean, everybody who's listening to this talk has worked through stuff in their life, right? Anybody here not worked through stuff in their life? When you were in, there was a time when you thought your stuff was real, right? And it had you in its grip, right? And then you kind of work through it and you realize, no, it's not real, right? I can work through it. I can let go of it. It's just conditioning. It's just the past. The past doesn't exist. Yes.
How do we care for each other if there are no selves?
I would say the opposite. It's because we identify with self that we don't really care for each other. That the less self you have, the more openness that the sufferings of others, the concerns of others, the needs of others, the happiness of others become your concerns. That's the truth. Again, I mean, you don't have to believe me. You know, I'll take the same stand the Buddha said. You know, just check it out for yourself. Do your own investigation into the nature of your own self. Can you find this self? I mean, is there a little Fred inside me, you know, it may be this big. I mean, you know, everyone, for those not here, everybody in the hall is laughing. But it's like that. I mean, if you think you have a self that's running the show, where is it? You know, can you find it? You know, I mean, again, you laugh when I say, is it like little Fred this big and he's in his own little control room, right? What kind of levers, you know, like Star Trek or something, you know, navigating the ship of Fred through space? Could be. I mean, I'm serious. Find out yourself. This is the freedom of Buddhism. It says, inquire. Look deeply. Look deeply into your own experience. What is true? I mean, we use these words, self, non-self. Find out ourselves. Yes.
So on the humorous side, there was a note from Mauricio who said, the monsters in the closet hide when the lights are turned on.
Really? Well, Mauricio, next time you think there are monsters, and we'll end on this note. Next time, Mauricio, you think there are monsters in the closet, and you turn on the light, and if you say they're hiding, they have to be hiding somewhere. Okay? So I would say, you know, get out your flashlight, tear the closet apart, and you decide whether there really are monsters hiding. This is important. I'm glad you said that, you know. Yeah, our investigation has to be thorough. As long as you think, believe, that there is somebody lurking, a self that needs to be fed. And I assure you, your self is demanding that we feed it from morning till night. And demanding that everybody else in the world feed it. It is worth investigating. And I appreciate Mauricio, yes. If you just take a cursory look, and sort of you go, well, there's nothing there, but you still feel there's something there. You haven't looked deep enough. We have to come to the conclusion. There's nothing in the closet. Right? We have to understand clearly, as long as there's some belief, well, maybe the snake turned into the rope when I brought out the flashlight. And as soon as I leave, it's going to turn back into a snake and bite me. As long as you believe that, I would just go back out and just shine your light and make sure that it's a rope. Unless you you live in magical thinking. If you live in magical thinking, then it could be anything. There can be monsters in the closet when there aren't any. There can be selves where there are no selves. There could be permanence where there's really impermanence. There could be happiness really where there's just dissatisfaction. We have to look deeply. This is the great gift of Buddhism. It gives us the tools to look deeply into our life. So good. Thank you, everyone. People on retreat, people in the Sangha who are listening today. We'll end now.